welcome again to our reading of Time Magazine. This is your reader, Randall Rickman, for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for folks who are blind and print impaired. We are reading Time Magazine, and this issue is dated twice, March 2nd and also March 9th, so it's a double issue. We've got a lot of material to make our way through. First order of business is to make sure that you know our website, which is ncreadingservice.org. And we are going to start our reading with the interview portion of the magazine. We jump right to that to make sure we include it in this session. It's called Q&A, and the interview is being conducted by Katie Steinmetz for Time. The interview subject is Kimberly Crenshaw. Time says, Kimberly Crenshaw is a law professor at Columbia and UCLA who coined the term intersectionality to describe the way people's social identities can overlap. Kimberly Crenshaw on the politicization of her idea, the lasting relevance of it, and why all inequality is not created equal. First question. You introduced intersectionality more than 30 years ago. How do you explain what it means today? Answer. These days, I start with what it's not, because there has been distortion. It's not identity politics on steroids. It is not a mechanism to turn white men into the new pariahs. It's basically a lens, a prism, for seeing the way in which various forms of inequality often operate together and exacerbate each other. We tend to talk about race inequality as separate from inequality based on gender, class, sexuality, or immigrant status. What's often missing is how some people are subject to all of these, and the experience is not just the sum of its parts. Question. How do women experience inequality differently than men? Where do we see that in our daily lives? Answer. When we talk about inequality, why are we often talking about material differences in conditions of life? Take income inequality. Numerous statistics show that women still get paid less for the same work. That multiplies over a lifetime and means that the problem gets worse the older women get. There's also a term called the feminization of poverty, which speaks to all the ways that life circumstances, like child rearing, divorce, illness, impact women more profoundly across the social plane, from issue to issue, from institution to institution. You see women doing on average more poorly than men. Question. How does race affect that picture? When you add on top of that other inequality-producing structures like race, you have a compounding. For example, data show that white women's median wealth is somewhere in the $40,000 range. Black women is $100. Question. Where do you see politics coming into play? Answer. The issues that concern women are often afterthoughts. Even the Democrats' approach to racial inequality is focused primarily on men and boys. Anything that's meant to address gender inequality has to include a racial lens, and anything that's meant to address racial inequality has to include a gender lens. Unfortunately, that hasn't been the center of political and policy debate. Question, why not? Answer. The image of the citizen is still a male citizen. When you get to a few gender topics like reproductive rights, then we talk about women. But politics and policy are pretty much like medicine used to be and still is. The male body is the body. Question. What do you make of criticisms from conservatives that concepts like intersectionality are a means of fetishizing victimization, that the left interprets disadvantages as a kind of moral superiority? Answer. Intersectionality is simply about how certain aspects of who you are will increase your access to the good things or your exposure to the bad things in life. Like many other social justice ideas, it stands because it resonates with people's lives. But because it resonates with people's lives, it's under attack. There's nothing new about defenders of the status quo criticizing those who are demanding that injustices be addressed. It's all a crisis over a sense that things might actually have to change for equality to be real. Final question. What advice would you give the average person about what they can do today to help achieve more equality in America? Answer. Self-interrogation is a good place to start. If you see inequality as a them problem or unfortunate other problem, that is a problem. Being able to attend to not just unfair exclusion, but also, frankly, unearned inclusion is part of the equality gambit. We've got to be open to looking at all of the ways our systems reproduce these inequalities, and that includes the privileges as well as the harms. Entire interview, Q&A with Kimberly Crenshaw, law professor at Columbia and UCLA. Interview conducted for Time by Katie Steinmetz. We now go to the front of the magazine, and we come to the page called For the Record, the one-page collection of tiny news items, each one illustrated by a caption in bold, a two-color drawing, or a combination of the two. In the upper right corner of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Jack B. Weinstein, Brooklyn federal judge who recently announced his retirement at age 98. Jack B. Weinstein on what he plans to do next. And the quotation from retired Brooklyn judge Jack Weinstein, quote, "I would like to take a master's degree in history," unquote. In the right margin of the page is a story illustrated by the monetary statistic in bright red, $70 million. Caption explains, box office debut for Sonic the Hedgehog, marking the best domestic opening weekend for a film inspired by a video game. This item is also accompanied by a red, white, and black line drawing of, presumably, Sonic the Hedgehog. Yes, you can tell it's Sonic because his director's chair has Sonic on the back, and he's wearing sunglasses, like a movie star. In the lower right corner of the page is the feature within a feature, Bad Week, Good Week. At Bad Week, Plymouth Rock, graffiti found February 17th on rock, marking 1620 arrival of the colony's founders. Graffiti. Under Good Week, rock music, Queen performed 95 Live Aid list, 85 Live Aid list, correction. Queen performed 85 Live Aid set list at the February 16th Australian Fire Relief Benefit. 85 Live Aid set at Australian Fire Relief. Running along the bottom of the page is a story illustrated by the statistic in bright red, 26%. Caption explains, approximate decrease in manatee deaths in Florida from 824 in 2018 to 606 in 2019, per the state's Center for Biological Diversity. And this item is also accompanied by black and white line drawings of four manatees. And the left margin of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Elton John apologizing for ending a February 16th concert in Auckland early because of walking pneumonia. Shortly after, he postponed several shows. The quotation from Elton John apologizing, quote, "I played and sang my heart out until my voice could sing no more," unquote. In the upper left corner of the page is a story illustrated by a text quotation in bright red from a resolution introduced by California Assemblyman Al Matarazushi up for a vote on February 20th, in which the State Assembly apologizes to Americans of Japanese descent for its role in Japanese-American internment during World War II. And the quotation from a resolution introduced by Assemblyman Al Matarazushi, quote, in bright red, "Given recent national events, it is all the more important to learn from the mistakes of the past," unquote. In the lower center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Kate Middleton, Duchess of Cambridge. Kate Middleton, in a February 15th podcast interview about motherhood and pregnancy. And the quotation from the Duchess of Cambridge, Kate Middleton, quote, "I actually really quite liked labor," unquote. In the upper center of the page is a story illustrated by a quotation from Christina M. Koch, spelled K-O-C-H. Christina M. Koch, NASA astronaut, on a viral February 13th tweet showing video of her dog's reaction when Koch arrived home after 328 days in space. And the quotation from NASA astronaut Christina H. Koch, quote, by the way, in all caps and bold black, quote, "Not sure who was more excited. Glad she remembers me after a year," unquote. That was the entire content of the For the Record page. We are now in the opener. That's the section of the major section, the brief. And the subsection here is World, where the headline is "The Olympic Size Risk of COVID-19. Article by Charlie Campbell. Before we get into the text of the article itself, it is accompanied by a sidebar feature, which is actually a metric feature in the center of the page, stacked three facts in bright red. Top fact, 9.6 million. Caption explains, number of visitors Japan received from China in 2019, 9.6 million. Middle fact, in bright red, 30. Caption explains, number of countries and territories with confirmed COVID-19 cases as of February 19th, including the U.S., Canada, and Russia. 30 countries and territories. Bottom fact, in bright red, 695. Caption explains, number of confirmed cases of COVID-19 in Japan as of February 19th. In bright red, 695 in Japan. Charlie Campbell writes, in a promotional video featuring Japanese tennis superstar Naomi Osaka, as well as fans of different nationalities, the organizing committee for the Tokyo 2020 Olympic and Paralympic Games revealed on February 17th the event's official motto, quote, "United by Emotion," unquote. Yet, if there's one emotion linking the world today, it might be fear. The COVID-19 outbreak shows little sign of weakening. As of February 19th, the disease has infected more than 75,000, killed 2,014, and prompted more than 50 nations and territories to close their borders to arrivals from China. The devil virus, as Chinese President Xi Jinping has called it, is on the cusp of becoming a pandemic. The coming weeks will determine whether containment efforts can prevent COVID-19. From now on, your reader will use its acronym name, COVID-19. The coming weeks will determine whether containment efforts can prevent COVID-19 from morphing into, quote, the black swan event, unquote, that Alibaba CEO Daniel Zhang has warned may derail the global economy. The economic repercussions already look severe. According to research firm Capital Economics, COVID-19 will cost the world economy more than $280 billion in the first quarter of this year. China's growth is expected to slow to 4.5% over the same period. Some 5 million companies have Chinese suppliers, according to data company Dun & Bradstreet. Apple warned on February 17th of global iPhone supply shortages. Travel in and around the region has ebbed significantly. Some 21 airlines have canceled all flights to mainland China. Hong Kong-based Cathay Pacific has cut 40% of network capacity and asked 27,000 employees to take unpaid leave to help it stay afloat. Events ranging from the Pan-Asia Sports Tournament, Hong Kong Rugby Sevens, to K-pop concerts have been canceled or postponed. Now, speculation is mounting about one of the year's biggest events set to take place directly in the orbit of the outbreak. The 2020 Olympics in Tokyo, beginning July 24th. Japan has the second highest number of COVID-19 infections after China, with 695 people testing positive for the virus, most of them on a cruise ship docked in Yokohama. Yet the Olympics torch relay is due to begin in March and traverse all of Japan's 47 prefectures over 121 days. And the games themselves are expected to draw 600,000 foreign visitors from nearly every country. According to Japanese public broadcaster NHK, Tokyo 2020 Organizing Committee Chief Executive Toshiro Muto voiced concerns on February 5th that COVID-19 might, quote, throw cold water on the momentum toward the Games, unquote. As speculation swirled, Tokyo Organizing Committee President Yoshiro Mori insisted on February 15th, quote, we are not considering a cancellation or postponement, unquote. And pointing out a reader error here, that date of that quote is February 13th. 4 days later, the city canceled its marathon, which was scheduled to take place on March 1st, for all except elite runners. Canceled for all except elite runners, repeated for clarity. Dick Pound, an International Olympic Committee member, parenthetically IOC, told Time, the organization is examining the situation closely, but not jumping to conclusions this far ahead of the Games. Quote, if there's a legitimate pandemic that is potentially a lot more lethal than normal illnesses or flu, that's when you need to start thinking about it, unquote. He says, quote, but not at this stage, unquote. The Tokyo Committee's confidence is in line with projections for COVID-19 that COVID-19 will fade during summer months, as SARS did in 2003. SARS is spelled all caps S-A-R-S, SARS. And for clarity, I'll repeat that sentence. The Tokyo Committee's confidence is in line with projections that COVID-19 will fade during summer months, as SARS did in 2003. But it's not clear why SARS declined as temperatures rose. Some coronavirus strains like MERS, all caps M-E-R-S, thrive in the heat. The theory is, quote, based on wishful thinking, unquote, says University of Minnesota epidemiologist Michael Osterholm, quote, there is no data to support it, unquote. It's hard to overstate the economic impact on Japan if the Olympics are canceled or relocated. The games themselves are set to cost $25 billion, with more spent on infrastructure to handle the influx of international visitors expected this year. Koichiro Takahara, CEO of Tokyo-based rideshare app NearMe, says he fears the Olympics could be canceled if the outbreak worsens. Quote, I am keeping my fingers crossed, unquote. That doesn't happen, he says. It would also impose a political cost on Japan's Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, whose cabinet has seen a slump in popularity, partly because of its handling of COVID-19. Skepticism will be rife, says Jules Boykoff, a professor at Pacific University in Oregon, who studies the games. Quote, for many, when they hear Abe and other officials saying that the virus will not affect the Olympics, they hear the unmistakable ring of previous empty promises, unquote. Then there's the cost to businesses that have plowed vast resources into securing rights deals and sponsorships. NBC alone spent $1.4 billion on broadcasting rights for Tokyo 2020. Both host and corporate interests will resist deviation, says Simon Chadwick, a sports industry professor at Francis Emilion Business School. Quote, the Japanese government is surely lobbying the IOC hard as it seeks to protect its multitude of investments, unquote, he says. That might explain an apparent unwillingness to address the uncertainty. Ask, what contingency plans were in place? The Tokyo Metropolitan Government told Time, quote, we cannot provide a definitive answer to a hypothetical situation, unquote. Yet, as the virus extends its tendrils further into the Asia region, the risks are only becoming more tangible. That is the entire article by Charlie Campbell, and Time notes, with reporting by Sean Gregory, Dateline New York, and Mayako Shibata, Dateline Tokyo. On the facing page, we have the sidebar feature, News Ticker. Three news items stacked one on top of the other. Top item, Virginia's ban on assault weapons fails. Governor Ralph Northam's push for a bill that would ban the sale or transfer of assault weapons was blocked after four Democratic lawmakers sided with Republicans to reject the proposal on February 17th. They voted to delay the bill for a year and ask the State Crime Commission to study the issue. Middle item, Attorney General Barr under fire. More than 2,000 ex-Justice Department officials signed a February 16th open letter calling on Attorney General William Barr to resign after he moved to reduce the sentence recommended for President Trump's confidant Roger Stone. Trump had attacked prosecutors' initial recommendation of up to 9 years in prison. Bottom item. Leak exposes China's Uyghur camps. A 137-page document was leaked detailing the Communist Party's crackdown on Uyghurs and other Muslim minorities in Xinjiang. The documents cite growing a beard and fasting as reasons for internment in camps, contradicting Beijing's claims that its policies are intended to curb violent extremism and provide job training. That brings us now to the milestones page. Lead item under declared Boy Scouts bankruptcy. Subtitle, Barraged by Sex Abuse Lawsuits. Observance by Elena Doctorman. Thousands of men who say they were sexually abused as Boy Scouts may finally get restitution, though likely not in the form of a large payout. The Boy Scouts of America filed for bankruptcy protection on February 18th, meaning accusers will watch the once hallowed organization's collapse, at least in its current form, under the weight of claims that the Scouts enabled generations of pedophiles. Quote, "It's not about the money," unquote, says James Kretschmer, 56, who has lived for 44 years with a memory of his Scoutmaster crawling into his sleeping bag and sexually abusing him. Quote, "It's crucial that the world sees how widespread this was," unquote. Since the January 2019 revelation that 12,254 children had reported experiencing sexual abuse in the Boy Scouts from 1944 to 2016, the organization has faced a deluge of lawsuits, so many that their insurance companies have refused to continue making payouts, arguing that the Boy Scouts could have reasonably prevented the widespread sexual abuse. Kretschmer is among 1,900 survivors planning to make a claim in bankruptcy court against the Boy Scouts. Though the Boy Scouts' assets exceed $1 billion, its significant debts and the sheer number of claims mean payouts will likely be minimal. Advocates are urging victims to come forward before the chance expires. A court will set a deadline, likely 1 to 2 years from now, for individuals to file claims. After that time, no one will ever be able to sue the Boy Scouts for abuse again. Accuser Gil Gale, 58, says the bankruptcy filing could mean many allegations will never be heard. Quote, "That wave of dread and anxiety is just too overwhelming for a lot of people," unquote. Entire observance written by Eliana Doctorman, Boy Scouts bankruptcy. This item is accompanied by a full-color photograph. It is an extreme close-up. Caption says, "A Boy Scout wears a sash displaying his earned merit badges at a ceremony in New York City in 2015. The right margin of the page, under died. Caroline Flack, UK Flashpoint. Observation written by Alex Reese. Caroline Flack, a British TV presenter, best known for her work hosting the popular reality show Love Island, died by suicide on February 15th at her London home. She was 40. Ahead of the premiere of the show's sixth run in January, Flack stepped down from her role after being charged with assaulting her boyfriend. Flack pleaded not guilty and was awaiting trial in March. After her death, her management criticized prosecutors for orchestrating a, quote, show trial, unquote, saying she had endured, quote, significant distress, unquote, because of the allegations and how they were sensationalized by the British press. Flack had long been a tabloid fixture, and her death prompted calls for newspapers to stop publishing invasive stories dissecting celebrities' private lives. On February 17th, during a televised tribute, Love Island's narrator remembered Flack's, quote, passion, warmth, and infectious enthusiasm, unquote, for the show. Quote, my only hope is that we can all try and be kinder, unquote, he added. But in a culture of relentless tabloid and social media scrutiny, few expect kindness to prevail. Entire observance by Alex Reese, Caroline Flack, 40. That item is accompanied by a headshot of Caroline Flack. She is smiling in the picture. Under died. Good Times actor, singer, and composer Jeanette Dubois, at 74, died at her California home, her family said, on February 18th. Under announced on February 18th that Saturday Night Live cast member Kenan Thompson would host and that Netflix comedian Hasan Minhaj would be the featured entertainer at the White House Correspondents' Dinner on April 25th. Under pledged $10 billion on February 17th by Amazon CEO Jeff Bezos, the richest person in the world, pledged $10 billion to fight climate change. It's roughly 8% of Bezos' wealth. Under extended, the working vacation visas of any visitors to Australia who stay to help wildfire recovery efforts on affected farms. The six-month visas have been extended to 1 year. Under announced, new post-Brexit immigration rules by the UK on February 19th. From 2021, the new system requires foreign workers to pass an English test. Applicants to, quote, shortage, unquote, jobs, or those paid more than £25,600, parenthetically $33,170, will be prioritized. Businesses said the move could hurt the economy. Under stolen, 600 rolls of toilet paper on February 17th, stolen in a knife point robbery in Hong Kong, which is experiencing a shortage due to panic buying related to the ongoing coronavirus outbreak. 600 rolls of toilet paper stolen. And that was the entire content of the Milestones page. On the Facing page, under the recurring headline, Good Question, the title is, Can a White House Envoy Deliver Afghan Peace for Trump? article by Kimberly Dozier, who writes, for more than a year, U.S. envoy Zalmay Khalilzad has been trying to negotiate an end to the 18-year war in Afghanistan. Now Khalilzad, or Zal as he's widely known, is confident he's on the brink of inking an elusive peace deal between Washington and the militant group that sheltered al-Qaeda terrorists while they plotted the attacks of 9/11. If he succeeds, Zal will deliver a pivotal election year victory for his boss, President Donald Trump, who has long pledged to end America's involvement in, quote, endless wars, unquote. If he fails, the U.S. will remain mired in the longest war in American history, a conflict that has killed more than 3,500 U.S. and NATO troops, cost the U.S. government nearly $900 billion, and left more than 100,000 Afghan casualties and millions more displaced. Khalilzad's allies, say the Afghan-born diplomat, is a wily and skillful deal-maker who brings a rare combination of regional experience, ambition, charisma, and healthy cynicism to the job. But his detractors in Washington worry that he'll say anything to anybody to get the key players to sign off on a deal for Trump, whether or not it's built to last. At its core, Khalilzad's deal offers this basic bargain. The Taliban will reduce its violent attacks on U.S. and Afghan troops, and the U.S. will withdraw much of its forces from that country. Talks between the Taliban, Afghan officials, and other Afghan parties will determine the future shape of the country and the militants' role in it. On February 14th, U.S. officials said the Taliban committed to a 7-day, quote, reduction in violence, unquote, to show it's serious. But its leaders won't publicly agree to Washington's demand of keeping U.S. counterterrorism forces in Afghanistan. To get past that roadblock, Khalilzad has come up with a rickety workaround. The deal contains secret annexes, according to three people familiar with the draft. An agreement for U.S. counterterrorism forces to stay in Afghanistan for now. Details of a Taliban denouncement of terrorism and violent extremism. A mechanism to monitor the semi-truce while talks between warring Afghan parties proceed, and details on how the CIA will operate in Taliban-controlled areas. The State Department and Khalilzad's office declined to comment on those annexes, and a Taliban official has insisted they are just, quote, rumors, unquote. The fragile deal could be signed by the end of February if everyone stays on board. Taliban leaders could refuse to work with Afghan President Ashraf Ghani, who on February 18th was declared the winner of September's disputed presidential election. Taliban fighters could break the week-long ceasefire in reaction to their leaders agreeing to allow some U.S. forces to stay behind. Or Trump could tap out a damaging tweet and send his envoy back to the negotiating table. For Zal, it would be the deal of a lifetime. And for the Afghan generation that has grown up during the war, the stakes couldn't be higher. Entire article by Kimberly Dozier. Underneath that, running along the bottom of this page, under the general heading Crime, the headline is Bungled Burglaries. Lead-in says, two burglars who broke into a London LGBT bookstore lingered long enough to get caught in the kitchen drinking Prosecco, reports emerged on February 13th. Here, other thwarted thefts. This article by Suyin Haynes, and Suyin Haynes lists three examples running along the bottom of the page, left to right. Number one, on the left, hanging around. In 2011, a burglar in China's Liaoning province tried to climb through a fifth-floor window into an apartment, but got stuck dangling above the street. Firefighters rescued him before handing him over to police. Middle item, car calamity. A suspected car thief in Pretoria, South Africa, was caught when an auto lock system trapped him inside the car he was trying to rob in 2014, reportedly imprisoning him for over an hour and a half before the owner returned. Final item on the right, identity issue. In March 2019, police accused a Montana man of breaking into a bike shop and stealing some sunglasses and a bicycle. He left his wallet and state-issued ID behind, making it easy to track him down. Entire article by Suyin Haynes. And moving ahead, we're now in the section of the brief called Health, where the headline is, Your Brain Knows the Meds You Need. Article by Mandy Oaklander. Seeking out help for depression is hard enough. It doesn't make sense any easier. It doesn't make things any easier than that it can take weeks, months, or longer of trying different treatments to find something that works. Antidepressants can take at least 4 weeks to start working, and research has shown that only about 30% of patients respond well to the first drug they're prescribed. Quote, right now, treatment selection is purely based on trial and error, unquote, says Dr. Madhukar Trivedi, a professor at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical Center. But promising new research published in February in Nature Biotechnology suggests that a simple brain test paired with artificial intelligence, parenthetically AI, can help. Trivedi and a team of researchers took data from a previous study in which more than 200 people with depression had an electroencephalogram, parenthetically EEG, a non-invasive test that records brain waves, and were then given either sertraline, parenthetically a widely prescribed antidepressant marketed as Zoloft, or a placebo for 8 weeks. I'll repeat the main part of that for clarity. A team of researchers took data from a previous study in which more than 200 people with depression had an EEG and were then given either Zoloft or a placebo for 8 weeks. They then created a machine learning algorithm to analyze the EEG data, which found that 65% of study participants who shared a particular brainwave signature also showed a strong response to sertraline. This, says Dr. Amir Erkan, one of the paper's authors and a professor at Stanford University, is, quote, far better, unquote, than using clinical factors to try to guess whether they will respond well to a drug. The researchers also applied the AI algorithm to data from a separate study in which people had EEG testing before undergoing transcranial magnetic stimulation, parenthetically TMS, a brain stimulation technique to treat depression. They found that people who were not expected to respond well to sertraline, based on their brain waves, tended to have positive responses to TMS. Though this research is still preliminary, quote, these are exciting results, unquote, says Michelle Ferrante, the Computational Psychiatry Program Director at the National Institute of Mental Health, which funded the research. Quote, this EEG lab test is quick, unquote. It takes just a few minutes. Quote, cost effective, and its outcome is of high clinical impact, unquote. The next step is to conduct clinical trials in which AI suggests a treatment based on the patient's EEG patterns, quote, to see if these results hold true, unquote. Erkin believes that in 5 years, his team's prediction tool will be in clinical use. As a personalized approach to depression emerges thanks to AI, Trivedi hopes people will be more inclined to seek and stick with treatment. Quote, it gives patients a lot more confidence in the treatments that they are being provided, unquote, he says. Quote, that improves their ability to stay with that treatment until they get better. We are not shooting in the dark, unquote. Entire article with mistakes. Article by Mandy Oaklander. Mistakes by your reader. Moving ahead, we have moved now to the next major section, The View. And this subsection is The Risk Report, a recurring feature, where the headline is, what Germany's election bumps may mean for the EU. Article by Ian Bremmer. On February 10th, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, the head of Angela Merkel's Christian Democratic Union, parenthetically CDU, and presumptive heir to the chancellorship, announced that she would be resigning as party leader, a position she narrowly won just over a year ago. AKK, as she is known, was Merkel's preferred successor. The announcement marks the true end of the Merkel era. That should worry Europe a lot more than it does Germany. AKK's short tenure as head of the CDU was marked by a number of unforced errors, and she never found traction among the German populace. But the final straw that forced AKK to step aside was the decision of the local CDU chapter in Thuringia to ignore her order to refrain from working alongside the far-right Alternative for Germany, parenthetically AFD, to elect a leader to the state parliament. That violated the long-standing agreement of establishment German parties to refuse to work with the far right, forcing Merkel to step in. There was no recovering from that. AKK bowed out. It is tempting to blame AKK for not being the same caliber political operator as Merkel, but AKK also had the bad luck to be the one responsible for uniting a CDU split by the issue of refugees, a division laid bare by Merkel's 2015 announcement that Germany would take in more than a million. The race to succeed AKK is on. Among the front runners to replace her are Health Minister Jens Spahn and Prime Minister of North Rhine-Westphalia Armin Laschet, as well as the runner-up in last year's CDU contest, Friedrich Merz. But the reality is that Germany doesn't change all that much if it's AKK at the helm of the CDU or somebody else. Nearly 70% of Germans continue to have a favorable opinion of the EU, and roughly 70% also believe their economy has been strengthened by the economic integration of Europe. as the fourth richest country in the world and one of the least corrupt, it has social safety nets that work. This is not to say Germany is immune to the anti-establishment push sweeping through other advanced industrial democracies lately. But unlike most others grappling with the phenomenon, Germany's electorate isn't running to the political extremes in droves. Parenthetically, though, the recent rise of AfD is worth monitoring. Instead, they are opting for parties like the Greens, who represent a break from traditional German politics, but remain firmly within the pro-EU fold. There are plenty of countries that wish they had these problems. But German leadership matters for many more people than just Germans. For the better part of her nearly 15 years in power, Merkel has made German leadership indispensable to the functioning of the EU, especially in times of crisis. That has meant everything from standing up to Vladimir Putin over his land grab of Ukraine to shepherding along an unpopular Greek bailout needed to keep the Eurozone crisis under control. Even that 2015 refugee decision that cost Merkel so dearly domestically was critical as leverage to govern the EU as a whole. For the past decade, every time the Europeans have come to an existential crossroads, it has been Merkel who has shown them the way forward. The next German chancellor won't be Angela Merkel and won't have near the political capital to take the difficult European decisions that she made. At a time of U.S. retrenchment, U.K. dysfunction, and growing global instability, Germany will be fine no matter whom the CDU selects. The EU is another matter. Entire article by Ian Bremmer. Sharing this page, in the right margin is, under the general heading baseball, the headline is, A Season of Astros Anger. Article by Sean Gregory. This article is accompanied by a photograph. Caption says, Astros owner Crane addresses the media on February 13th. Spring training is truly an occasion for optimism. When players report to camp in February, warmer weather feels closer. No team owns a losing record. Happy thoughts abound. Not this year, since the Houston Astros are set to spoil the baseball season. Houston had already given away all goodwill. In January, an investigation found that the team took part in an electronic espionage scheme to steal the signs of opponents in 2017 and 2018. Then, in a universally panned February 13th press conference, Houston owner Jim Crane argued that the Astros' cheating didn't impact the outcome of any games. He contradicted himself less than a minute later. Picking up on Houston's remorse was difficult when you're almost in awe of the doublespeak. Opposing players lashed out at the Astros and MLB Commissioner Rob Manfred, who hasn't stripped Houston of its 2017 World Series title or punished any players. The Astros could have owned their errors and begged for forgiveness. Instead, all Houston can do is prepare for a season of jeers. Article by Sean Gregory. That brings us to the section called World, where the headline is Jacinda Ardern's Next Big Test. Subheadline, The New Zealand Prime Minister earned international acclaim for her leadership in the face of tragedy. Now she has to persuade her country to keep the faith. Article by Belinda Luscombe, who writes, History came fast at Jacinda Ardern. Just a few years ago, in 2017, having been a local member of parliament for a matter of months, she became a Hail Mary candidate for prime minister, a millennial woman thrown into an election at the last minute to resurrect the fortunes of her slumping party in a Pacific Island nation of 4.8 million people. With a mere 7 weeks left in the campaign, she put together enough votes and allies to form a government. She officially became her country's leader around the same time she learned she was pregnant with her first child. In the past year, she's been confronted with a mass shooting committed by a far-right extremist, a suddenly active and deadly volcano, and most recently, a global virus that originated in her nation's most important trading partner. Nearly any of those would have been enough to capsize an experienced captain with a crack crew of advisors, let alone a rookie with an untested team whose platform was built on kindness, acceptance, and inclusion. But Ardern's deft and quietly revolutionary management of these crises, especially the Christchurch shootings, got noticed around the globe. Her gender and youth, she's 39, were always going to make her stand out in a field dominated mainly by gray old men. These attributes, however, are just the wrapping. Ardern's real gift is her ability to articulate a form of leadership that embodies strength and sanity, while also pushing an agenda of compassion and community, or, as she would put it, quote, pragmatic idealism, unquote. And we have run out of time for our double issue of Time Magazine, which will be good and active until March 9th. One of many corrections necessary for today from your reader, Randall Rickman, for North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time for Time.